Good morning, everybody. How are we doing this morning? Good? All right. Hello, and welcome to Ancient Grains Brewing Traditional African Beer at Home. My name is Chris Hummert, and I'm your representative on the American Home Brewers Association Governing Committee. Before we get started, please take your seats and move towards the center of the aisles for any latecomers, which make sure to also turn off your cell phones and silence them to avoid any disturbances during the session. We will be taking questions at the end of the session using that microphone right there in the middle of the audience. So please come up to that so that everybody can hear your question and it's also recorded. Before we get started, I want to quickly remind you that the American Homebrewer, as an American Homebrewers Association member, you have access to over 450 recordings of seminars just like this one on homebrewersassociation.org. Recordings from HomebrewCon 2020 will be published later this year. Follow the QR code behind me to access the seminar's archive. Finally, at the end of the session, please make sure to submit a feedback survey. This will be in your app. It's just a quick two questions, and your feedback does help us present a better seminar. Now, I'd like to briefly introduce our speaker for this session. Lucy Korn is a beer writer and editor with Cape Town, South Africa. She started the Brewmistress blog in 2011 and became editor of On Tap magazine in 2016. She also started the African Beer Cup, which is the continent's biggest beer competition, and was the first certified Cicerone in Africa. Thank you, and enjoy your session.
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining. I know this the 9 o'clock session's a tricky one, you know. Look, it's not the 10 o'clock one, I think. Okay, we're going to... That is working. I'm not going to go through this because I've already said all of this. Wonderful introduction, thank you. So, obviously, the session is about traditional beer. Across Africa, sub-Saharan Africa particularly, there is a very, very long tradition of brewing with what we would consider alternative grains. This is just names for traditional beers in various different countries. I won't go through all of them, but they're using sorghum or millet, or in West Africa, fonio, which is quite similar to a sorghum grain. So it goes by many different names. There's a lot of similarities. There's also obviously differences in grains, differences in the brewing process. The beer I'm going to talk to you about is the one that I know best because it's what's brewed in South Africa. And in South Africa, we have 11 official languages. But there's one sort of name that is widely understood when people are talking about the traditional beer. And so it comes from the Xhosa language, which was Nelson Mandela's language from the sort of eastern side of South Africa. So it's a language with clicks. So the Q is actually a click. So the pronunciation, which hopefully I'll get right, because sometimes I do and sometimes I don't, is umkomboti. So you can practice that later on, you know. So the Q is like a... So it's umkomboti. And it's like I say, it's from one of the South African languages. But if you talk about umkomboti in South Africa, everybody knows what you're talking about. So my journey with this actually started really before my journey into craft beer and into, you know, sort of loving beer and wanting to know more about beer. I was backpacking in South Africa as long before I lived there. And, you know, when you're traveling, you want to taste the local foods and see what's happening in drinks. So I think a lot of you will remember the beer that maybe inspired you to brew, or the beer that made you open a brewery, the beer that made you really, wow, this is something I want to do. What you might not have is a photograph of this. I happen to have a photograph of my very first taste of umkomboti. Was it love at first sip? Not necessarily. I think everything about the beer was unfamiliar to me. I mean, you know, at this point, I was in my 20s and a lager drinker, you know. But everything about this beer, including the way it was served, everything about it is served in a communal sort of pass around. And I think my face says it all, like, trying to be polite, but also, like, what did I just put in my mouth? But over the years, it's because it is quite a sour beer, as you will find out later. Over the years, I think I've tasted it, you know, sort of every now and then. Actually, recently, a couple of years ago, I was in Botswana, and they were like, oh, you've got to have Chibuku while you're here. Really, do I? And then they got a carton of the beer. And all of a sudden, I tasted it, and I had a second sip, which on this occasion I didn't. And then I had a third sip, and I was like, ooh, actually, this is something I can get behind, you know? And so this started for me quite a, I don't know if love affair is the right word, but deep interest, let's say. So what I find fascinating about the beer is, I've sort of said before that it has a lot to do with the beer that you see in hieroglyphics, you know, without the drinking straw, although you could probably use one. It wouldn't hurt. So cereal-based beers, obviously, they go back a very long way. But in the case of Umkomboti, it's very much an oral history. There's so little written about it, which fascinates and saddens me. It's really difficult to find information, literally, about how old this particular beer is, how far back this brewing process goes in South Africa, really anything. So it's very much an oral history. So, you know, it's been passed down through generations, and you have to chat to people, and you're obviously getting, you know, a story that's been passed on and maybe changed through the years. What I also find fascinating is it's really still very traditional. It's like it hasn't been affected by all of the advances in technology that brewing, as we all know it, has been affected by and benefited from. It really hasn't. It is brewed commercially. I'll go into that a little bit later on. But yeah, for the most part, it's still brewed, well, we assume it's still brewed the way it always has been. We don't really know how it always was, but it seems like it's not really changed. So what is it? So it's uncarbonated, murky, thick, sour, and low in alcohol. It's like every craft beer trend of the past 2 years in one glass. And yes, I did just quote myself here. I have quoted my own article. But yeah, it is really, I think you have to put aside what you think of as being beer before you taste it, which is why I wanted to taste later on. I didn't want people to taste it and then go, what is this? And leave before the talk started, you know? So it's literally, you just have to put aside everything that you think about beer being carbonated and maybe clear and with the frothy head and all of this. Just put that aside. One of the reasons I thought it would fit for the conference is because it's kind of like the original homebrew. It is still typically brewed in the home. Like I say, there is some commercial production. More so, it's, for example, in Zimbabwe. It's still very popular and is brewed on a commercial scale. But in South Africa, certainly, it's quite difficult to find. I live in Cape Town. It's almost impossible to find a commercial version in Cape Town. I've never seen it, actually. In other parts of the country, it's sort of more easily found. So it's always been brewed in the home. But again, quite different. So here's a little sample of a few things that you will not see at a Umkomboti brewer. So hops predates, the use of hops in beer. And basically any kind of measuring instruments. So I think as home brewers, it's a bit of a struggle to not want to use those, gadgets. But traditionally, here's a few things that you, excuse me, that you will see, which you might not be quite so familiar with. This was from a brew day that I was lucky enough to attend in Zululand. It's in the northeast of South Africa. And it wasn't like a tourist thing. We'd found someone who hooked us up with his grandmother, who was known in that area for her brewing. And this was her equipment. You know, it wasn't pulled out for us to take photographs. It was not a touristy area or anything like that. So it just kind of goes to show that it's still just done on an extremely traditional level. So, ingredients. It varies, as I said before, varies by country. Millet, fonio, cassava as well in certain parts. But in South Africa, the main ingredient is malted sorghum. I do have some, which I brought it with me from South Africa to do the brew. That's a whole other story that I'll tell you over a beer afterwards. I do have a couple of bags left over. So if at the end, if you think, oh, this is something, and you want to do it on a really mini scale, there's probably enough for like 5-liter batch or something like that. So kind of first come, first serve, you can come grab. Or if you want to use sorghum in another brew. The reason I brought it with, malted sorghum is available in the States, but I don't know if it's the same. I don't know, you know, how it's processed, and it's a different species, not the right word I'm looking for. So yeah, I brought with. So malted sorghum and then maize meal, which I also have a bag of, which you definitely can get in America. Originally, it's assumed at least that it would have been probably 100% sorghum because maize only made its way into South Africa in like the 16th century with Portuguese explorers. So, you know, it's used to sort of gives a smoother beer. I think I've never made it actually with 100% sorghum, but a friend of mine, she said, no, the maize gives a smoothness, you know, mouthfeel, but also in flavor. And the only other ingredient is water. So traditionally, no yeast is added. People do, you know, they add yeast, add sugar to get a bit more alcohol out of it because it's quite low alcohol. But traditionally, these are the ingredients. And the bag actually has a little recipe on there. So, you know, it's available in supermarkets in South Africa, and it's got a little recipe. I followed this recipe earlier this year, and it was a disaster. But I'm not sure if that was the recipe or me. So, so it kicks off with... So what's interesting about you, you know, you think about a brew day. It's not a brew day. It's a brew week. And so it's a little process each day. So day one, it kicks off with the sour mash. Now, I need to say as well, because the process of making umkomboti is typically, you know, it's been passed down through generations. If you ask people, why are you doing this at this stage? The answer is usually because my mum did that at that stage, you know. So I have been working with a few of the craft brewers, and we're trying to sort of, you know, piece together the process. Oh, this must be because of this. But we're still kind of working out why we're doing what we're doing. But, you know, I mean, I've learned to brew from a friend of mine, Nolu, who's in Cape Town. She learned from her mum. And my recipe, she is her recipe, basically. She shared her recipe with me. And sometimes I ask her, but why this and not this? And she's like, that's what works. So just do that. So I think if you do have a go at brewing it, it's very much relaxed. Don't worry, have a home brew. Like, you just don't worry about it. It's fine. Whatever you're doing is going to be fine. So it kicks off with the sour mash. You've got boiling water. The grains go in. A lot of mixing. The dough balls with the maize are something else, like next level. So, and then it's covered briefly. Cold water's added. I'm going to put up a recipe later that goes into a bit more specifics on amounts. And then cover it, ideally with a tea towel or a cloth or something, not a sort of well-fitted lid. You can expect the next day quite a bit of funk. Bit of barnyardiness, maybe a bit of blue cheese. There are some interesting aromas throughout this process. So we're creating the lactic acid and kicking off gelatinization is what we think is why I start with boiling water as opposed to just adding you know, mash temperature water. You leave overnight. So I've always brewed it in the evening, leave overnight, and then the next evening you carry on with the process. The next stage is the boil. So this, again, was back in Zululand. Traditionally, it's brewed outside. There'd be a couple of reasons for that. One, I mean, if you've got a grass roof, then, you know, having the fire going for an hour inside is probably not going to be a great idea. Also, there are a lot of aromas at this stage. So all of this that that you're smelling in the sour mash now is coming off in the boil. When we had a homebrew competition to do umkomboti a couple of years ago, and on the WhatsApp group there was a lot of, is it supposed to smell like this? What does yours smell like? And my son had to, you know, go and shut himself in the bedroom because he just couldn't bear. So if you brew outside, you know, if you want to go full traditional, then you build a fire and brew it over the fire. Some people pull off a portion of the wort at this stage before the boil to add back later. I don't in my process, just because, you know, Nolu, who gave me her recipe, doesn't. And at this stage, so after the boil, it's the only part of the process where children have any kind of involvement. And a friend of mine just has the most wonderful memories of his childhood. This is his favorite part because it's now a really thick porridge. And they'd pull off some of the porridge, maybe sprinkle a little sugar on or whatever, and the kids will go and eat the porridge. It's called omhiko, I think. At least that's in Tswana. I don't know what it's called. There's so many different words for everything. Here you can see close, so you can start to get an idea of the color and the clarity of this. So yeah, it's boiled for about an hour. You know, stopwatches and things, not quite as important as when you're used to brewing. The main process here is the gelatinization, because sorghum gelatinizes at a higher temperature. So it is, you're boiling the mash. There is a lot of potential for it catching on the bottom, which with our brew did happen. It's going to happen, you know, because you're boiling a lot of grain. And yes, driving off some of these volatiles. So it doesn't smell great at this stage, but you want that stuff out of your beer before you drink it. Day three, so it cools then overnight after boiling. And then fermentation, so you're adding back another portion of sorghum. So no yeast is added, it's wild yeast, wild fermentation, but also adding back another portion of sorghum. And if you took off that portion of wort before the boil, then this is when it gets added back in. But once it's cooled, so it's basically, you know, day two, boil and cool overnight, and then day three, it could be first thing in the morning you could pitch the sorghum, or you could leave it until the evening. Some people are adding sugar and yeast at this stage. Obviously, this is before it gets obviously mixed in, and again covered, left overnight. And then straining. So at the top you can see the traditional, I think this is one area where times have moved on. People don't really use these sort of grass woven strainers anymore. This is my very rudimentary straining method, a sieve over a pot in my bathtub. I wouldn't recommend it because it's very, very thick. And it takes forever to get it through a sieve. So muslin bag is the way to go. You just, you know, squeeze it out. And again, you leave overnight. So at this point now you've got clear, but that's not a word you would use at all. But less grain in suspension, let's say. It is a chewy beer. You know, it's quite interesting. A lot of this, you know, like milkshake styles or... And the opaque, you know, like hazies. Yeah, this was around, this was the original hazy. And the original milkshake, I guess, beer. And then day five, it all depends a little bit on the temperature. Like if it's in summer, you can do this in 5 days. If the ambient temperature is not that warm, you're going to need an extra day, either in the fermentation stage or after straining. You know, it just depends how much it's bubbling. You will see very easily that things are happening. I think one interesting thing as well about the fermentation stage is, as far as we can work out, fermentation and mashing and then basically going on together, because now you've gelatinized the sorghum and we're mashing and fermenting at the same time. So I like to think of it, it's all the steps that you're familiar with, but in a different order. Same steps, different order. So it is a beer that's served while actively fermenting. So this is why, you know, you don't age it. I mean, I suppose you could, but it's on day five when it's foaming, like, well, you know, it's actually, you know, have a beautiful krausen, and they're like, right, it's time to serve. Traditionally, it's served in what's called an ukamba. So it's a clay pot, and it's a communal vessel. So, you know, sort of sip and pass along. This was from a competition that happens each year in September in Johannesburg. This would be the traditional way. That's the ukamba. Here's a close up. This photo is a bit of a cheat because what's in there is actually saison. But it's such a nice photo. But typically, you know, if you've got a really good ferment of the umkomboti, it will look similar to this with the big sort of frothy head, except it would be sort of pinkish and larger bubbles. But it gives you an idea of what the vessel looks like. This was in Botswana. This was the version that made me sort of step up and go, oh, actually, I could like this. So this is when it's brewed commercially. It's packaged in what basically are milk cartons. You cannot package this beer, good God, not in glass. And you can't, not even in plastic, because it's still fermenting. So the cartons, and for some reason I didn't think to take a photo, they have a little vent on the side to allow the CO2 to escape. And those in the know, you know, like if the carton's completely clean, you don't want it because it's too fresh. And if it's got a lot of dried on sort of, you know, frothy beer, you don't want that either because that's now finished fermenting. So you want where you can actually see action going on. So, you know, they'll know you're a newbie if you... if you take the one with the dried on beer. So yeah, it's a very interesting, the whole sort of culture around it, you know, is everything about it's different. This was my version that I brewed for a homebrew competition, which I didn't have any milk cartons, you know, and I needed to take it to the brewery where we were having the meeting. It was about 10, 15 minute drive from my house. And so at the last minute, I didn't want it spilling in my car. You do not want this spilling in your car. So I put the caps on at the last minute, and 10, 15 minutes down the road, these things were, you could feel the pressure in them, and I was too scared to open it. So Letu, who's he's got a brewery called Ukamba. He's originally from Zimbabwe, and he loves Mkomboti. And I was like, please, can you deal with this? And it took him a long time of just like a little bit of release, a little bit of release. So you can just see how much action is still going on. So just a quick recap on the recipe. I apologize. I, for some reason, managed to change the top thing into gallons and then failed to do anything else into imperial measurements. But the ratios vary. So the recipe on the sorghum bag is 50-50 sorghum and maize, whereas the recipe that Nolu gave me is 2-1. So this is the recipe that I use. And so you start with the boiling water, add the maize meal, cool it overnight. Day two, you boil further water, then add the mash to it, cook it, stirring a little bit to try and stop it from catching. Again, cool it overnight. Day three, you add back the sorghum. That's when you've got the fermentation and mashing going on. You have to employ the art of guesswork quite a lot of the time. The first time I brewed it, after the fermentation, it was... there was no liquid. And I'm like, whoa, this can't be right. And I couldn't get hold of Nola, so I just looked at it and just kept pouring water in and mixing it until it looked right to me, which I think is a big part of this. It's, you know, it's sort of, does it feel right? You know, it's intuitive, I guess. You'll then see, you know, bubbling action on day four, so then strain, leave it overnight, and then when you've got that lovely frothy krausen, drink it. Get your friends over and drink it immediately. It's not getting any better. It's like the IPA, you know, best before yesterday sort of thing. Drink it very quickly. So one thing that I love about it is just how traditional everything around it is. There's still a lot of customs and traditions. It has always been and still is brewed by women. So it's, you know, to find a man who brews it is quite unusual. I've actually met one guy, and he's like considered, why are you brewing beer? And it's passed down from, you know, aunt to niece or grandmother to granddaughter or whatever. On drinking day, so a little bit gets poured out for the ancestors, the brewer will take the first sip to prove that, you know, it's okay for you to drink. And then it's passed on. Then it will be the oldest male, usually, and then passed around the circle, taking a sip of the Ukamba and then passing it along. It's always drunk either sitting down or on one knee or crouching. Drinking while standing is like... it's a no-no. It's disrespectful. There's a few things I love, like bees. If you see a bee on brew day, it's going to be a good batch. Don't really know why, but that's one of the sort of customs around it. And then you've got this lid. So once the Ukamba's been passed around, if it's empty, if the drinkers put the lid on this way up, that means they want to refill. Basically, and then if the lid goes down, it's like, okay, I'm good. I've had enough. And As I say, it's usually brewed for ceremonies, but there'll be someone in each village who's known for their brewing prowess. And then word will get out, it's like such and such is brewed, and people will come over, and maybe sometimes it'll be sold, sometimes it'll be, you know, just have some. Sometimes it'll be maybe traded for whatever. And in Lesotho, they have flags, because Lesotho is very, very rural, and there's not many shops. And so there's different colour flags system. So maybe you're baking bread, and if I want bread, I can come buy bread from you, and you put up, I forget the colours, but a green flag. And then if you're brewing beer, and you've got some beer available, you put up the white flag, and I'm like, okay, I know, I can come to your house to buy some. So the real reason that I'm quite passionate about the whole thing, and I'm actually in the very early stages of hopefully writing a book because there's so little written about it, you know, is that it's basically endangered. They added, I don't know if you've ever heard the Arc of Taste, it's something by the slow food movement, and they have these foodstuffs that they consider, you know, they're in danger of dying out. And Umkomboti was added to that. The reason, one of the main reasons for this, I mean, it's associated with rural living and people like, oh, this is, you know, something my grandfather did, something my grandfather drank. So there's a part of that. But it's also, because it takes 5 days to brew, and a lot of now younger people are not living in the sort of rural areas, it's usually brewed for a wedding or a, you know, maybe a funeral or some kind of christening, whatever. But because of the five-day process, if you're living in Johannesburg and you're going home for the wedding, you'll arrive back on Friday. But the brewing started on Monday or Tuesday. So people aren't, you know, younger generations are not learning the process of how to brew it. So it is something that, it's definitely, I don't want to say dying out, that's not necessarily true, but it's definitely becoming more difficult to find someone who knows how to brew it. It did have a brief renaissance. So I don't know if you know, during lockdown in South Africa, we had an alcohol ban on and off, total of about 4 months. So as you can imagine, home brewing was huge in South Africa, along with bootlegging, of course. At one point, homebrew stores were closed because they weren't considered essential. But supermarkets were open, and these ingredients are available in supermarkets. So once people had gone through, pineapple beer, it's not really beer, but fermenting pineapples, basically. And then it's like, oh, what else can we turn into alcohol? So they actually had a brief flurry of interest. This is actually just before lockdown. I've been involved with the homebrew club. Our homebrew club is called the South Easters. And I've been involved one way or another for about 10 years, and never in that time had they done anything with traditional beer. And I asked people who'd started the club, and they'd never, ever had a challenge. So we challenged the members. We got about a dozen entries of varying quality, I guess you would say. As homebrewers do, this was one of the entries. So it had Mulberry's Coconut, Sabra, and Enigma. I did a version with granite... passion fruit, which actually turned out really well. I think the tartness of the beer and the tartness of the passion fruit work well together. But there's quite a lot you can do with it. You know, if the base beer is a little bit too weird, but then if you start adding, you know, put some cryo in there, some fruits. And the other thing that I love is that the craft brewers are embracing it in South Africa. Some craft brewers are embracing it. Now, it's not a beer it's not going to catch on a big scale. It's just not. But I think some brewers are taking inspiration from it. So this is Letu again, who has Ukamba Brewery in Cape Town. He was, I think, one of the first people. He does a sorghum saison. It's just about 40% sorghum in the grain bill. And he grew up drinking Umkomboti. And then he got into beer. He started working in a bar in Cape Town that has lots of beers. And he was like, I want to be able to bring the two together. And then one day he tasted a saison. He was like, oh, I can see some synergies here between. So he wanted to use sorghum in the saison. So here he is filling up his Ukamba, which he doesn't sit past. He'll just drink the whole thing there. It's a great beer. I wish I could have brought some with. His sorghum saison is a beautiful beer. This one... It was actually a collaboration with Garrett Oliver. Garrett came down to South Africa a couple of years ago for a conference, and he was really wanted to taste, traditional beer. As I said, it's very difficult to find in Cape Town, and we hadn't brewed a batch specially. So a friend of mine who has a restaurant and brewery, someone who works in the kitchen, oh, I know someone who makes it. So she got hold, and it came in a 2-liter Sprite bottle. And this thing was, the lid had been on for I don't know how long, and it was rock hard. Well, I'm not touching this. So we're sitting around the table. There was about 8 of us, and Garrett took on the challenge of opening the bottle. I have never seen anything like it in my life. He loosened the cap. It shot off. The beer shot out, hit the ceiling. Everyone got soaked, apart from Garrett, who moved with cat-like finesse. And so they'd brewed a sorghum saison, and the brewer called it quick hands just after Garrett, because the way he moved out of this, he didn't get a drop on him. It was amazing. And then there's a brewery in just outside Cape Town called Soul Barrel. Now, they've done a few collabs, but they're actually they make their own kombucha and then blend it. He does a lot of barrel-aged and wild ferments kind of stuff. So he then blends it back with one of his wild beers and then barrel-ages it. He's the person who's doing the most innovative stuff, you know, and he collabs with a brewer in Johannesburg. She actually didn't grow up, that she never was interested in the brewing of traditional beer. Then she worked for SAB for a while, became a brewmaster, you know, and then she'd go home and was like, maybe I should actually ask my mom how this is brewed. And now she's really passionate about renewing interest in Umkomboti. And this was so this has been now aged and it's fully fermented out, so we can actually put it in glass bottles. So, you saw the picture at the beginning, and the look on my face is that I call it a slow romance. Recently, I was invited on a tour to go and taste some traditional beers. And although the photo doesn't quite, I think it was more about the awkwardness of having the photo taken. But they gave us little mini ukambas. They'd had special ones made, mini ones, because of COVID and sipping and passing and putting your mouth around the same things kind of, you know, taking your mask off to then share a ukamba doesn't really make much sense. And I was the only person who managed to finish my little ukamba. It was only half full. But over the years, it has it's grown on me a lot. Now, you're going to get a chance now to have a taste and to maybe you can photograph your moment of first tasting. You get a photo of the person next to you when you first taste it. So, as I say, I bought the grains with, and I contacted the local homebrew clubs, and Trub, the Three Rivers Underground Brewers, got back to me. And Paul, who is here, give us a wave, Paul. Give it a round of applause to Paul, please. A bigger round of applause. So Paul was the guy who stepped up, and because people were like, oh, this is weird. I mean, I didn't sell it very well. I was like, I wanted people to be aware that it was that it was weird, and there was going to be some weird smells going on, and, you know, if you don't want funk in your home brewery, then it's not for you. And he was like, I'll give it a go. So we mashed in, or sour mashed in, on Sunday, and then Paul's just ran with it for the rest of the week and sending me photographs. Is this the right? I'm like, looks perfect. I tasted it this morning. I've actually got my here. Yours is coming now. So you will see it is quite thick. I actually did a very good job of straining it because often there's actually little grain particles. But it's very thick. I think you used the phrase yogi sip, didn't you? It is exactly like that. It's like a yogurt drink. That's the texture. There is a bit of smokiness, probably more than you would normally find because the grains did catch quite a bit during the boil. The sourness level is spot on. So it is a pretty good example. I mean, and they vary so much because people vary, you know, the process is all different. So as it's coming round, please have a taste. Maybe take a photo of your friend having a taste. And I'd love to know what you think. I've got 3 bags of sorghum and 1 maize meal. So I think I've got to take it already. well, maybe we can kind of divvy it up. I mean, you can get sorghum. There's actually a maltings in Pennsylvania. I can't remember the name of them now. That apparently I found this out after I'd mulled this stuff from South Africa and sweated my way through customs and and sweated my way across New York, pulling 16 kilos of grain along with my other stuff. But yeah, you can actually, I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of places where you can't, I just don't know if the sorghum is the same. So I don't know how the beer is going to turn out. But then you can like make an American umkomboti, you know, throw some citra in there or something. Okay. So tasting time, we are serving now from the pitcher. Have a taste, let us know what you think. And that's all from my side, but questions, if anybody has questions, they'd like to come up to the microphone.
Oh. Hi, thanks so much for that. I've got two questions for you. So you mentioned earlier on, so I want to talk a little bit about the role of women in brewing. So traditionally the women brew this beer, but you did mention the drinking, that it goes to the eldest male first. So my first question is, do the women drink the beer, or is it generally more the men that's drinking it? My second question is, given the tradition of women brewing these traditional style beers, how is that reflected in today's both home brewing and craft brewing industry? I do know about Tolokazi, the brewer, but apart from her, how is it in general? How are women perceived in the brewing industry, given this really strong heritage?
Awesome questions, thank you. Typically it will be more men doing the drinking. And there might even be some, you know, the men will be drinking here, maybe the women will be drinking in a different part of the house or something. It depends, I think, on the situation, you know, on the occasion, I should say. But you will generally find it's a circle of men drinking. It's quite old school in that sense. Regarding women in brewing in South Africa, it's male dominated for sure, but there are quite a few, not necessarily female owned breweries, but quite a few women brewers within the craft beer industry, and it's certainly something we're seeing growing. The Beer Association of South Africa is very, you know, they've had sort of grants and stuff to encourage more women into the industry. And elsewhere in Africa, I don't know if you've heard about Kweza in Rwanda. So Kweza is their slogan is women-owned, women-brewed. So it's probably, because it's the first craft brewery in Rwanda. Sort of. Yeah, they're brewing on a small scale, like on a grain father at the moment. Their equipment is still in South Africa. They're waiting for premises. But they are trading, and it's available in certain bars. And so they're not fully operational. And I think they're probably right in saying, they've said that because it's the first craft brewery in the country, it's probably the first country where the first brewery is completely run by women, which is, you know, it's quite cool. So, yeah, we're moving in the right direction. Home brewing, there's not a great deal of diversity. I'm often the only woman at the homebrew meetings. We did, in fact, the first or second president of the club was a woman. I used to run the club, and then the previous president was a woman. So, yeah, we're getting there slowly. Thanks.
Have you come across any reuse of culture for the fermentation aspect, or is it always just reliant upon I'm going to pitch the extra grain that's just got whatever on there?
So the only example I can think of, and I didn't even register it at the time, when I went to the Zululand, the super traditional brew day, I didn't notice at the time, but I've got a photograph. She'd gone into the house and came back with a stick, and I didn't think anything of it at the time, but that would, you know, sort of be like the quake, the reuse. Yeah, and it wasn't actually, I think I'd read Lars Gotthold's book on the farmhouse brewing in Scandinavia. And then I was going through photos for a presentation or something. And I was like, oh, wow, I have a photo of the stick. So, yeah, I guess that would be the reuse, yeah.
And there sounds like there's probably not enough data points yet, but like in Belgium, you know, the temperature is such a important thing in terms of sours. Have you noticed a difference from winter to summer brewing?
I did a winter brew recently that was an absolute disaster. It was too cold. And I messaged Letu and I was like, I got the most ridiculous pellicle I've ever seen. Like, I sent a photo. I was like, I know this is not normal, but is it okay? And he was like, it's a beauty. And I was like, oh, so it's fine. He's like, oh no, throw it away. but it looks pretty. And he's like, have you tasted it? And he said, like, for him, he's like, no, it's going to be nice and sour because he loves it very, very sour. So yeah, I think it's often not brewed in winter because it's so weather dependent. We brewed here this week, and as you may have noticed, it's been quite warm this week, and it's turned out. It's quite sour, but it's pretty much spot on for what it should be.
Hi, I do medieval reenacting demonstrations, so I'd really like to plug in for a couple, because I would be brewing that and sharing it the traditional way. And one of the things that I did last, in 2019, was the farmhouse brewing, the Scandinavian farmhouse brewing on the tutelage of Lars Marius. And when you were going through this, I'm looking at this. This is like South African farmhouse brewing. And then when you brought up the magic stick, the yeast stick, it's like, how much of a overlap do you think with the traditional homestead, like cut off the world, cut off modern convenience brewing, does the farmhouse and the South African brewing overlap?
I think there's a lot of overlap. When I read his book, it suddenly made me realize, that what's happening in South Africa is very much, it's different ingredients, but a lot of those, what we would think of, I guess, as more unusual processes, like boiling the mash, for example, and, you know, there were so many similarities.
When you were going through and saying this looks unusual, I'm like, that's exactly what I do when I make a farmhouse beer. I use a half barrel and I use the same sticks and I'm using the same filters.
That's
and
amazing.
It's
I would love to, you know, if you brew a batch of Mkomboti, I'd love to see photos and things of how it turns out. That'd be great. We'll chat after.
Good. And I'll learn how to do the click.
Yeah, I'm still learning.
All right. First, thank you so much for coming. This was a really interesting. Okay, now that I've got that out of the way. I was curious about when you mentioned the homebrewing community and some of your own brews, you mentioned adding passion fruit to a brew. At what step in the process would you add fruit and whatnot, and what process would you use to add fruit to?
My process was very much just throw it in, really. I split my batch into three, and I had one straight up version. And then I did two with passion fruit. One I added in that post straining. I don't want to say lautering, but post straining, and then left it overnight. That one also had a pellicle, and I don't think I'd recommend it. It went incredibly sour. And then the other, so I strained the granadilla, sorry, we call them granadillas, passion fruit pulp. And then the rest I added literally at bottling, basically, just before serving. And that one actually won the competition. It was the first time I'd ever won a homebrew competition. It's the only time I've ever won a homebrew competition. So a lot of people added raspberries, but I think it was all very late in the process.
All right, thank you.
Thanks.
Hi. First of all, love this class just because history lesson. You know, beer is actually the third oldest drink in the world, so it's such rich history behind it, so thank you for bringing that out. So this beer requires the wild yeast in order to ferment. If you don't plan on inoculating, you plan on going full traditional. Can you ferment this outside, or would you recommend fermenting outside, and do you put any sort of covering on it during that fermentation phase?
I cover it the whole time with like a muslin cloth. So, you know, you've still got microbes can get in. I'm not sure, Paul, what did you cover during?
This was in my garage, and then I just had a grain bag that I just pulled over the.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Pulled it over, so it was very, lots of air to get through.
Hmm. And outside, depending on the weather, I guess. If it's cold, then definitely not. when I was having trouble with my batch a while ago, I kept putting it outside during the day in the sun. I was like chasing the sun around the garden trying to heat this thing up. It didn't help. But yeah, and covered. You could leave uncovered. Usually it's covered loosely, you know, with a bag or some kind of fabric, I guess.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You talked briefly about two of what's probably many big pressures on how this brew gets made in the modern day, the timing aspect of this, you know, pretty much a strict 5-day schedule, and then the we want to experiment, we want to make something new, adding other things. Is skipping that up to a more meta level, is there conversation about how this brew gets preserved, adapted, advanced in its interaction with the modern world?
I mean, it's becoming more of a conversation with the craft brewers, certainly. It's an interesting, because the larger breweries that brew it, when they formed the Beer Association of South Africa a few years ago, it was supposed to be, it's a coming together of the big breweries like SAB and Heineken, the craft breweries, and they have their own association. And then the sorghum breweries, but they completely backed out. They're quite secretive and strange about the whole thing. There was a big survey looking at the entire beer industry, and parts of the report got redacted. And in the craft brewers, like 40% of it was redacted or something, and in the big breweries, because they didn't want certain statistics. You know, Heineken, SAB didn't want certain statistics. So a certain portion of that. I can't understand this, but the sorghum one was 100% redacted. They just so this. I don't know. I don't understand. And then they backed out of the Beer Association altogether. So on that level, I really don't know. I don't have any sort of contacts there in the industry. But it is. There's becoming more and more discussion about it within craft beer. You know, typically the craft brewers in South Africa were copying originally like German styles, and then very much, you know, trends from here. And only recently, I think, they started embracing our brewing heritage. And I think it's a way that could actually, in some ways, preserve the beer. There's a couple of entrepreneurs who are doing flavored versions as well. So you can buy in the carton, and then it's banana flavored or mango, I think, is one of the ones they do. So, yeah, there's definitely more discussion about it, more conversation about it now than there was, say, 5 years ago. So hopefully that's helping.
And is that taking place on the home brewing level as well, or is it still very traditional where they don't, that's not really consideration what they're doing?
There's one, I've actually got one. Thank you. So there's one competition, annual competition in September in Johannesburg that's aimed at home brewers, whether they're home brewers of traditional beer or, you know, the homebrew clubs. We've done two events in Cape Town. What surprised me was, so we did South African National Beer Day, which is in the start of February, and we did a brew outside on a fire outside of a friend's craft brewery. And then when it came for tasting, people were like, what is that? And I was like, but you're South African. How have you never seen this? How have you never tasted it? And there were so many people there who didn't know what it, like, they didn't know it was going to look like this. They didn't know it was going to, like, they had no idea about it. There's a lot of work to be done.
Thank you.
I'm working on it.
Thanks so much, Lucy. This has a pretty distinctive, like, smoky, burnt rubber phenolic note to it. Is that typical of... So,
to some extent.
Okay.
It's more the smokiness is actually coming. There was quite a lot of charring of grains during the boil, so it's definitely more prominent than it would be. It does have a slight phenolic character to it and a slight smokiness, because you will always get some kind of burning of the grains. But this is more on that. We said we've invented Rauch und Kombotti. Innovating.
Thank you for the talk. You said about keeping it warm. What sort of temperature? Because, I mean, obviously, you know, UK, we're not anywhere near that warm. So, yeah. Would you recommend sort of temperature control if you're going to try and do this?
I really don't know how to answer that question. Yeah. I'll be honest with you. It's just like whatever. I'm just trying to think. So the temperature in my house when it didn't ferment was probably about 15. So warmer than that for sure. I mean, it was a Celsius. Yes, sorry, I don't think in Fahrenheit. Yeah, No, that would be quite cool.
Like 65 Fahrenheit.
Like, okay. As I would say as an absolute minimum. But this week, I mean, the ambient temperature in your garage is probably like 30. I'd say probably above 20, but I really don't. It's just one of those things, all the temperatures throughout, you know. I mean, this is the first time Paul actually took pH, because he's a homebrew, couldn't help himself. So he's like, I must have some data. And it was the first time I'd ever, like, I just never think about it because I'm just following this traditional process that's been passed on, not down to me. But I'm not really sure. But maybe you can experiment and let me know.
So one question to you is, what was the pH?
the first day after you just do your sour mash, it was 3.8, I think.
Okay.
What was the next time I took it?
I think it was after straining. It was 3.5.
Yeah, after straining. So then, like, you have a couple days there, and you mix in more grain, and then you strain it all out. It was 3.5. So that was yesterday, basically, or 2 days ago. And then over the 1 day of, or 1.5 days of fermentation, it got down to 3.2.
Thanks. This is really fascinating. One of the thoughts I had, you talked about adding passion fruit and going that direction, but when I smelled it and I got blue cheese, and I don't mean this as a joke, but has anybody tried to do this, like pairing it with like olives and going that martini direction?
I can honestly say that had never occurred to me before. Not to my knowledge, no, but why not? You know, it certainly does have a sort of, blue cheese note to it. Just going to put that slide up.
Couple of quick questions. One is, what's the ABV? Is it rather low?
Oh, that's a very good question. It's around 3.5. Okay. The cartons, when you buy it, they actually have a plus minus 0.5% because obviously it's still fermenting. Okay. And so there's a little disclaimer on there, but it's usually between 2.5 and 3.5.
And I'm just curious with everyone here, who liked it and who didn't. So who liked it? Raise your hands. Okay, pretty good.
Oh, that's a great question. And did any? I hope someone's got a selfie or a photo of their first sip of it. You know, it looks better than my first sip. I want to see your photo afterwards.
Well, thank you. This is kind of seems every instinct that you have as a home brewer. You need to just do the opposite. But I wonder, is it traditionally kind of served room temperature when it's, you know, in the commercial ones? Are they on the shelf or in a refrigeration?
They will keep it in the fridge, but, yeah, it's usually served at room temperature. I mean, when I had the carton in Botswana, they put it on top of the fridge for a while to, you know...
To heat it up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I am well. You?
I have a question. Since you're using tea towels and things to cover muslin cloth, and you're basically relying on ambient microfauna, microflora, have you noticed, is there a distinct difference between batches made in certain areas? Is there like a terroir aspect to it? And have any of those been sort of isolated and kind of looked at under a microscope?
To the second part, not to my knowledge.
Okay.
I actually don't know. It's funny enough, I've just been invited to judge in a competition in September, which is going to be really interesting for me because I don't really know how to judge it. You know, it's going to be fascinating because there'll be brewers of traditional beer that I'm going to learn so much from. So I'm quite excited. You know, I mean, I think there's so many other variables that I don't know how much of it would come from... like the terroir aspect. One of the main variables is most of the people I know who brewed it don't really, we don't entirely know what we're doing. So there's like other things going on. I'm hoping to travel around, do a lot more research, you know, in the sort of eastern part of the country in particular. So I can get back to you in a few months with that.
So how many do you think you'll have to judge? Is it like New England IPA round?
probably no. It's going to be a few less entries than the National Homebrew Competition, certainly. I would guess 10.
Good luck.
Hi, thank you.
So traditional Belgian, old-style Belgian beers, when they open ferment them, they tend to do it in the same room, so it gets a lot of that same flora, fauna kind of thing. Do these cloths that cover it, is it the same cloth that just kind of gets used over and over again, or do they clean it in between, or could it be reintroducing the same kind of flora that's previously used for fermentation?
I actually don't know. It's a great question, and I'm going to write these questions down so that I can start doing more research on it. I'm not sure about that at all, but I'll try and find out. Thanks.
So follow-up to the question where how many people like this, how many people, this is what happened to me, how many people didn't like it on the first sip, and then after third sip, you cannot put it down? It's like, whoa, what is that? And then, well, like, I went for a refill.
Okay. Oh, awesome. That's great to hear. I think quite a few people came in at the end and didn't hear the talk as well. So the reason I wanted you to taste was just, you know, to get a bit of a background so that you didn't have the, what on earth is this? Like, what are they tasting here? So, yeah, that's great. That's great to hear. I think one last word from our brewer.
For those who still want some more, this will be, if there whatever's left, it will be at the club night tonight, either under the troop table or the other trash table. So
if there are people you know wanted to taste but went to other talks, then they still can taste it. Go get refills, people. I need to get a refill as well. Great. Thank you so much. Thank you for all the questions. That was awesome. Cheers.